as we begin the second chapter, he leans backwards and we remember he talks about how the word was sounded out by the people in Thessalonica in verse 8. He's going to spend a lot of time in the beginning of chapter 2 of 1 Thessalonians talking about the process of sounding it out and this business of preaching and teaching, and he's got some things to say about that which are very useful and very helpful. So, as is so often the case, we have a chapter break, and it's a perfectly logical place to break the chapter, but when it begins with the word for, that tells you that you're building upon information that was previously put in place. For yourselves, brethren, know our entrance in unto you, that it was not in vain, but even after that we had suffered before and were shamefully entreated, taking you back to Acts chapter 16, shamefully entreated, as you know, at Philippi, we were bold in our God to speak unto you the gospel of God with much contention. For our exhortation was not of deceit, nor of uncleanness, nor in guile, but as we were allowed of God to be put in trust with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God, which trieth our hearts. For neither at any time used we flattering words, as you know, nor a cloak of covetousness, God is witness. Nor of men sought we glory, neither of you, nor yet of others, when we might have been burdensome as the apostles of Christ. A lot of negative things said here about what he didn't do. And when we consider ourselves listening and paying attention to preaching and teaching, we have a lot of good instructions from the Apostle Paul as to how these things ought to play out. We see how things ought to be. Now, we saw in the previous chapter, in verses 5 through 9, Paul had a consistent manner, and he was known by these people, and his manner was something that was a virtuous manner, and he was consistent in that. When you come to then chapter 2, he is speaking, standing on that manner of life. Mm-hmm. That shouldn't be lost on us. As we then speak and we want people to listen, is our manner of life a testimony that gives credibility, or is our manner of life a testimony that undermines our credibility? If you consider there was a day when God saved your never dying soul and you lived a long time until that happened, or you lived a short time, you lived a certain amount of time as an unsaved person, no doubt there's quite a treasure trove of sinful behaviors that were back there as an unsaved person. God saves your never dying soul. He makes a new creature out of you. And as a new creature, we are to learn how to walk in newness of life. So this new creature then, he needs some equipping.
Yes.
He needs to learn. It's not uncommon for a newly saved person to be a little bit sketchy at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And to have some ups and to have some downs, and the process that is being learned is Ephesians chapter 4, verses 22 and 24, learning how to put off the old man, learning how to put on the new man, learning how to walk in newness of life, learning that their life no longer is their life, but they were crucified with Christ, learning that their life now is no longer theirs, but it's been hid in Christ. And as those doctrines are put into the person's inner man, the inner man gets strengthened, and that strengthened inner man starts to trend toward a manner of life that's coming out of the woods and doing some better. Now, all of us would like to think that the day we were saved, we became a great saint of God, and we've been 100% consistent ever since. And no doubt you lie about other things.
Right.
Because you're not that, and nobody is. But there is a process and a growth process. Now, the thing that is important to realize is that this inventory of sinfulness is imputed to the Lord Jesus Christ. His righteousness is imputed to you, and you're to walk in that and not in the old man. You're to put off the old man and walk according to newness of life. So when you have escapades, and who might be a good example, whether it would be Jimmy Baker, Jimmy Swaggart, some of these guys that have been in ministry for a long time, and they have these terrible indiscretions. Those things are supposed to be on the other side of your salvation, not on this side of your salvation. Walking in newness of life doesn't go to the no-tell motel with a floozy and a Polaroid camera, somebody got or not. So it's then a manner of life that improves rather than drops off. So I've said before, and I'll repeat today, sometimes you're not dealing with a spiritual giant. Sometimes you're dealing with a spiritual babe. But if he's going in the right direction and doing the best he knows how, and he gives every evidence of that, I'm for him and I'm with him. If he's a spiritual giant, he's living down here, and every trend line looks like it's going the other way, I'm sorry. There's work needs done. You're not living a manner of life that constitutes you being in a platform to present Christ and Him crucified. Very hard when your manner of life bespeaks an unsaved person. You're supposed to let that behind. Now, a lot of times, and let me say it this way, a lot of times folks will have, they'll say, it's really hard to witness to my family. Here's why. They know you. They remember you.
Yeah.
They know you.
What makes you that did this think that you can talk to me?
See, they're not respecting what's going on.
So,
the advice I've always given is, well, shut up. They're not going to listen to you anyhow.
Right.
Look for an opportunity. And let's build this a while. Comes a point where they'll say, boy, things have changed with you.
Yeah,
let me tell you about that. So Paul then is able to speak his manner of life being known and established. Obviously, to the unsaved people, you walk up to Joe Sixpack and you got a six-pack yourself, you're one and the same. He's not going to think you credible on subjects of salvation. Here's the fact. Saved people don't pay any attention to you either. Your credibility with Christians, actually, most Christians are looking for something to dislike.
Yeah.
Something to pick at. Christians just got that about them.
Yeah.
And, well, why are we mid-Acts Pauline dispensational? You want to give a list as to why, according to denomination? We can do it, right? I went to Terry Smith's website yesterday to see just what flavor of Christian he is, bringing a Koran down there in Florida. He's an apostate.
Yeah.
No point talking to him.
No.
No point telling him he's wrong. No point telling him he could use a little more wisdom and knowledge. He's got it direct from God. He's an apostle. You're wasting your time to talk to him.
Yeah.
So, you'd have to start with salvation and how nobody gets saved in Acts 2:38. But Paul has a manner. Our lifestyle as believers, Paul says, all things are lawful unto me. Did he do all things?
No.
No. Some things are not expedient. He wouldn't eat the offering because it would offend an unsaved person or offend, be a stumbling block to a weaker brother. So he constrained his behavior to exhibit legalism. It wasn't about legalism. He constrained his behavior so that he would not be a stumbling block. His manner mattered. Because his manner, if it was reprehensible, would get in the way of his message. You see it? So, this business of the gradual growth, hopefully, that's something we're all experiencing. Hopefully, we can look back to 2 years ago and say, well, I'm doing better now than I did then. I got a long way to go, but I'm doing better now than I did then. Look back to 10 years ago and so on and so forth and say, well, I'm doing better. Then, when you're standing on such a platform, and this is, was so important to our, some of the founding evangelists in this country in the 1700s, and their manner of life, oh my, they were so stringent about their behaviors. I mean, talking to Puritans and talking to Wesley and some of these guys are so stringent. The reason, of course, they had a holiness conviction, but they wanted that platform just spotless.
Yes.
So that they could present Christ and Him crucified. So there's some wisdom there. If you're living and doing the best you can to live righteously, what does grace teach? Isn't that Titus? That denying ungodliness, we walk there it is, verse 11. The grace of God that bringeth all salvation, Titus chapter 2, verse 11. Thank you. Teaching us, what does grace teach us? We deny ungodliness, we deny worldly lusts, we live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world. When you look at the mid-Acts grace pulpit, you don't see that.
No, you don't.
You see lazy, intellectually lazy. You see lazy people. You see people that are trying to fit in, trying to make their ministry acceptable because everybody's right, nobody's wrong. Baloney. Titus chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. Verse 12, grace says deny ungodliness. So if you know it's ungodly, that verse cured me from voting for the lesser of two evils.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so you threw away your vote. Yeah, but I didn't throw away my doing the best I can as far as me and God is concerned.
Yes.
Hmm? I'm going to vote for the lesser of two evils anyhow. You made your choice. Then, worldly lusts. I was so complimented when someone said we looked at all the pictures you sent us and there wasn't any. You don't do anything worldly, do you? I was half offended till I thought about it. That's really a nice thing to say. Soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world. Wow. That's what grace teaches. Grace doesn't teach, doesn't matter. Grace doesn't teach whatever you think is right. Grace has a standard that, if you look at it from a distance, looks like he sure is legalistic. The way he lives, the way he says things. Well, you're doing that for the sake of the unsaved and for the sake of the immature. So Paul has a manner, and he stands on it, as he does so, he is engaging, he says in chapter 2, speaking unto you the gospel, exhorting, even so we speak. So he's talking quite a bit here about the presentation of the material. It's important to notice that there was a lot of contention with Paul. Don't be surprised when you get a lot of contention. There was much contention, and Paul was very careful that he didn't do anything deceitful. You see the list in 1 Thessalonians in chapter 2. He didn't do anything that was tawdry, that was unclean, that was the method so many ministries take now at presenting rock music, entertainment, borderline dirty illustrations. Christian comedians, they just walk a real fine line of not quite getting dirty, but they're just kind of off color. That'll get everybody back. No guile, no bait and switch, no sneaky stuff.
No.
Every head bowed and every eye closed and nobody looking around when there are eyes open, there are heads up, there are people looking around. And not doing it to please men. The old preacher John Wesley he liked to call himself an exhorter. And he would say that the time for the exhortation is such and such. And when the Church of England wanted to get rid of him in America, the Church of England was associated with the government. And the idea that you could not vote, you could not serve in the legislature unless you tithe to the Church of England was where we started.
Yes.
Okay, so you got that in place. So, if the Church of England has that level of power, and it did, then you got a guy out there preaching and teaching and you don't like it, you put John Wesley on a reward poster and you've got 200 shillings for a wanton gospeler. So he was wanted as a wanton gospeler. They'd arrest him because he wasn't adhering to Church of England doctrine, which of course was the tithed church of the state legislature. What a thing, huh?
Yeah.
Now, it's amazing. Folks talk about the issue of church versus state. To consider that you could not run for the legislature if you were not a tithed member of the Anglican Church, the Church of England, which we now call Episcopal. You had a placard on your pew. You didn't have a pew, you had a box. Like a box, a sheath in the low section of the Cincinnati. You got a box and you put your whole family in there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you close the door in your box, nobody else can go in there. Mm-hmm. So you can leave your Bible, you can leave your Psalter, you can leave your Book of Common Prayer, and you can leave it in there because that's your box. Nobody else is allowed in there. When you die, they'll dig up in front of your box and bury you right there in the Church of England. So when people are walking in, they're walking across the marble grave head of you. The idea of having that clean platform is so important, and it has really been let go badly in the grace movement. Now, I've given you a list of verses right here in your outline where Paul has some other things to say about his preaching. I love it when he says, though I be rude in speech, yet not in knowledge. Rude doesn't mean he's impolite, it means he's plain spoken. What we've got in our chairs upon which we are seated is something that has been sanded and varnished, so it is no longer rude. But when you cut down the tree before it was sanded, before it was varnished, before it was put on a lathe, it was rude, give you splinters. So that's the idea, rudimentary, basic. And he was rude in speech, yet not in knowledge. That seems to me to be a tremendous combination, because if you come off talking in such a vocabulary and so professorially that you're not communicating with a tremendous number of people, you kind of just beat the air, aren't you? So it's not that he dumbed it down, but he made it plain. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 10, he taught things that were weighty and powerful. He did not, although he spoke plainly, he did not shirk the heavy issues and avoid them. Now, frankly, these two verses, and you can make up your own mind, but these two verses have really directed my efforts in my radio program. I want to deal with the heaviest stuff there is.
Yes.
And I want to deal with it in a manner where people are intimidated or afraid, or talking to them in a language that's foreign to them. So to put it in plain vernacular, in Galatians, of course, we've seen as we studied Galatians that we keep the purity of the gospel and the purity of the doctrine. And in Titus, in chapter 1, verses 12 and 13, you see Paul, how do I say this and not be misunderstood? He's name calling, isn't he?
Yes, sure. Clearly.
I mean, you know, when he does that, yes, that's from being rude in speech. Do you know, I'm very suspicious that the Berean Bible Society does not know that Max Lucado is an amillennial, baptismal regenerate, unsaved in a pulpit. When they refer to him in their footnotes. So maybe you need to just come out and say that the Church of Christ are water dogs trusting the baptistry.
Yeah.
Well, to get, you know, I've suggested to you. But the level of ignorance that's out there is so thick you could cut it with a knife and spread it on wheat bread.
Yes, it is.
When Paul preaches and teaches, 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 21, he's not picking his audience. He's not deciding that he's going to tone it down for one and step it up for another. And in Acts chapter 24, you see him reasoning righteousness and judgment and temperance, and he's very heavily doctrinally oriented. He's not engaged in storytelling. He's putting concepts and principles out there. Not with excellency of speech. He's declaring the facts. He's declaring the doctrines. And that, 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 1. So Paul has quite a few things to say about what he's doing and how he preaches. If there are young men wanting to start ministry, their pattern needs to be Pauline and not somebody they saw on TV or saw in a pulpit somewhere. Their pattern needs to be their apostle, and that under the headship of the Lord Jesus Christ. We've got too many clones out there. And if you're a clone, I'm going to suggest to you that your audience is going to become drones, and that neither one of you are going to get very much done, because you don't initiate. You're a copycat. Paul warns against bad preaching and wrong preaching. And my, I've had a lot to say about Romans chapter 16, verses 17 and 18 over the years. Paul makes the point to separate from the people that are teaching wrongly, mark them and avoid them.
Yes.
When you stand fast with Pauline doctrine in your King James Bible, you'll be the one marked and you'll be the one avoided.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So today, you can reverse it. Because today, the ones that are getting it right, they're the ones ostracized by the crowd that would rather get along than get it right. Those are the two choices, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
In Ephesians chapter 4, you grow up, you're no more children. And the only verse in the Bible where the word pulpit appears is in Nehemiah. And in Nehemiah, I know it's a different dispensation, and I don't mean to fall into spiritualizing, but what I see him do is so plain and so simple. He reads what the text says, and he causes them to have understanding. He then, after reading it distinctly, verse 8, gives them the sense of it, and then when he causes them to understand the reading, I'm going to suggest to you that that's the sermon illustration. That's when you embellish it, tell a story about it, try to personalize it, and put it forth. So all the machinations of multimedia and some of the other things we've got going on now in the entertainment business, which Christianity has become, I don't find in my Bible.
No.
And when I find the only mention of the word pulpit and he's standing up in it, one of the things that the people obviously did is they revered the book.
Yeah.
They even stood up when he read from it out of respect.
Mm-hmm.
So, read what the verses say exactly. Give the sense of it. Sometimes folks might have a bit of trouble with a word here or there, or with a phrase here or there. So give the sense of it. And then you bring about, you cause there to be understanding with the illustrations. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul makes the point that you know our entrance unto you was not in vain. And at that point in your outline, I've given you a dozen examples of how knowledgeable the people in Thessalonica were. And your Christianity will not succeed on the merits of ignorance. We are not given a choice as to whether or not we should study. We are plainly told to study, to show ourselves approved unto God, to be workmen that need it not to be ashamed. It's not an option. It's not a matter of, well, I'll do that some other time. Because everything you do is going to be built upon the doctrine that's resident in you. The strengthening of your inner man is dependent upon the doctrine that is resident in you. And so study is an important thing. Over time, as 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 13 takes effect, and the word works effectually in you, and your manner of life, your discernment, your decision-making, all these things begin to improve. As that takes place, then, what you've got going on is exactly the right result. You're seeing happen what needs to happen, what ought to happen. In 1 Thessalonians in chapter 2, in verse 2, by the way, legalism will never get that done for you, because legalism, the law, focuses on failure.
Yeah.
It says, thou shalt not, 8 out of the 10 commandments. It tells you how you fail. Well, folks, we already do that. So now we need to set our affections on things above. In verse 2 of 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul talks about, even after that we had suffered before and were shamefully entreated, as you know, at Philippi, we were bold to our God to speak unto you the gospel with much contention. Don't look for applause. Applause goes to entertainers. I can remember the first time I ever heard anybody applaud in the church building. And I thought, what? Where did that come from? Now, I was in more of a fundamental Baptist background, so the charismatics have been doing it for years before the Baptists got around to it, mm-hmm. and applauding, and I thought, what is that? I mean, why isn't that extolling the virtues of a fleshly performance?
Yeah.
And isn't that just the opposite of what we ought to be learning? Mm-hmm. You, now it's pervasive. Now you get applause and lots of that kind of business. I'll have here in my notes, pause for applause. And the contention that you're going to get, most of it you're already expecting. Most of it you know to anticipate. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would not go to what was that thing that they had for men that the football players started? Promise Keepers. You wouldn't go to a Promise Keepers meeting teaching doctrine and be surprised at contention. Mm-hmm. I mean, when they started the first ever promise-keeping meeting with a Navajo blowing into a horn, we're off to a good start, right?
Yeah.
shamans on the pulpit, we're off to a good start. So you know there's going to be opposition. You know there's going to be contention. I would remind you, Paul being your pattern, you're going to have people slip away that are right close to you.
Oh, yeah.
You may, and I hope you never do, you may even have a Judas, a backstabber, attacker, sell you out. Happens. So the problem with contention isn't the contention you are anticipating. You don't see the submarines. You don't know the torpedo's been launched. You know,
yeah, that's
it
true.
Hits.
That's true.
And that happens. You say, oh, not among loving. Oh, yeah. That happens. It happens a lot. So, you get over it. Remember, in the Acts chapter 16 example that Paul is referring to, when he's there at Philippi and in much contention, here comes a damsel possessed with a spirit of divination, and what does she say?
Truth.
She says, absolute 100% truth. Mm-hmm. To your face. Behind your back, it's another story. The guys that are getting the money from her. So, these are the servants of the Most High God who show unto us the way of salvation. You'd think she could start a fan club, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, what are they going to do? Lock them up? Beat them? So, in Christian circles, that would never happen. Nobody would ever say something nice to your face and something nasty behind your back. It'll never happen.
No.
Well, maybe once. Well, maybe the preacher needs to know that as the people file out the door and say good message, Pastor, by the time they're in the car, the folks have already found something out they didn't like about it.
Yeah.
The joke is that nobody has fried chicken after church. They all have roast preacher.
Yep.
So, contention. There's no nice way to say it. If you can't stand the fire, get out of the kitchen. There's going to be contention. The world's against you. The flesh is against you. The devil is against you. And all three of them go to church.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, then, Paul says we didn't use flattering words.
No.
A cloak of covetousness. Sometimes churches get so caught up in raising money for this and raising money for that. And sometimes preachers get so caught up in wanting star power and wanting to be notable and all of that business that covetousness becomes rather a theme you can't get far away from. I'm thinking of one particular Baptist church that was so proud that it gave $250,000 to missionaries from a congregation of about 400 people. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you what, that's all you ever heard about.
Yeah.
That's all you ever heard about. I mean, every message had it in it, every sign on every bulletin board, every snap on the wall, everything you looked at, every picture was, it was so driven to raise money. Getting any doctrinal truth had been hard to do.
Yeah.
So this cloak of covetousness, Paul's against that. Again, the power of negative thinking. He's not flattering. He's not covetous. No, no, he's not hiding anything. It's not for his own personal glory. Doc Ruckman made a hilarious point one time. And this is maybe 15 years ago. He's repeated it just last week in the last Bible Believers Bulletin, which made me think of it. But when Curtis Hudson was editor of the Sword of the Lord, there was an issue of Sword of the Lord that had 22 pictures of Curtis Hudson in it. That's a lot, you know that? And as I saw that again here recently, I thought to myself, well, there's never been an issue of the Berean Searchlight that doesn't have on page one your editor. And that's more important than anything else is what I've got to say.
Yes.
That mentality.
Yeah.
There was a time when people were so humble, they put their editorial comments on the back page. No picture, and just sign it, editor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Those days seem to be gone.
Come on.
So he's not into any of that kind of business. And what Paul's giving us here in the first six verses and our embellishment of it from other things that he's had to say is quite a method of measuring what we're listening to. A really good opportunity for us to be less subjective and more objective about what we're hearing. Now, I end with a list of 21 things about Paul's preaching, which is pretty good stuff, and it's useful, I hope, for people thinking about messages they've been listening to. I also give you the only verse in the Bible that has the word share in it. Now, share shows up as a compound word attached to a plow.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the only verse that has only the word share. And oh, you know what? It's still a plow.
Yes.
So even the only mention of the word share is still attached to a plow. It's just a truncated word.
Yeah.
To sharpen every man his plowshare. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. And his counter and his axe. Counter is like a pickaxe. And his axe and his net. So he's got those things. The only mention of share, seeker-friendly sharing, is foreign to the Bible. Hmm?
Yep.
It's the currency of modern Christianity. So we got a lot here from our apostle about things he doesn't do and things he does do when it comes to preaching and teaching. We do well to take that inventory and apply it to what we listen to, and then when we have opportunity to speak, to always have them on hand and in the back of our minds so that we don't get off the proper path, and that our manner of speaking is also easily definable.